David Enmeyer has written the definitive biography of an iconic group who changed the way we listened and danced, the Bee Gees. The group sold 250 million records over their 40-year career. David is also the author of the biography of singer-songwriter Graham Parsons, 20,000 Roads, The Ballad of Graham Parsons and His Cosmic American Music. The LA Times chose the book as one of the 20 best nonfiction books of the year, and Rolling Stone named it one of the 5 best books of the year. David has taught cinema studies at the New School in Manhattan for the last 14 years. He's written on film and music for Entertainment Weekly, The New York Times, and Wired. His other books include The 100 Best Films to Rent You've Never Heard Of and A Girl in a Gun, The Complete Guide to Film Noir on Video. Welcome, David, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
Readers, I want to share that even if you aren't a mega Bee Gees fan, you should pick up this book because the writing is so fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, why, after your work on Graham Parsons, did you select the Bee Gees as your next project?
Well, there are two reasons. One is they're my agent's favorite band. And the other is that I felt that they were underreported, that nobody really knew anything about them, that they were one of the biggest acts in the world, which people forget, and no one knew a thing about them.
Right. And I wanted to also ask you, because you absolutely let the readers know that the band has never been given their proper due. Why is that?
Well, I think there's only two schools of thought on the Bee Gees, and one is genial contempt, and one is absolutely berserk fan zombiedom.
That's me.
And there's no middle ground. And I don't think people recognize what an amazing songwriter Barry is. I don't think they recognize how progressive they were in the studio and how many great songs they put out. They're regarded as cartoons now. And it's true, they presented themselves as cartoons, so it's their own fault. But the music and the family dynamics warranted a deeper inquiry.
Yeah, tell us more about their father, Hugh.
Well, Hugh was a guy who could never do anything right and could never make a penny. And the three boys were supporting their families from their early teendom, singing on the streets. And he was their manager in Australia and managed their career. And then as soon as they hit it big, he stepped out of the way. He was, as I say in the book, he's maybe the least abusive child managing parent in the history of child managing parents. But the family has always been very, very tight. And he and his wife always lived with one of their adult children.
I never knew about the sister, Leslie. What is she doing now? Is she still around?
Yes, she has a normal life in Australia, which is what she always wanted.
Huh. Okay, Barry and twin brothers Robin and Maurice were harmonizing almost before they could walk. Tell us about their earliest musical offerings.
They started singing at a child's lip-syncing contest, and the myth goes that they broke the record they brought to lip-sync to and then sang live. And they always had harmony from their earliest ages. They never had to think about it. They never had to plan it. They just knew how to sing together.
You know, I was kind of blown away by the fact that the Bee Gees doesn't stand for Brothers Gibb.
I know. I didn't know that either until I started the book. It stands for the name of the two guys who managed them when they were teenagers, who hired them to work at a racetrack. And both those guys' names, initials, were B.G. So they were the Bee Gees.
Who knew? You write, the boys never saw themselves as rock and rollers or folkies or as belonging to any type of music or scene. They were performers in show business, and their duty was to the audience, not themselves.
That's right. They were very much of a 50s entertainment tradition, because their father, Hugh, was of a 40s entertainment tradition. And the idea that what they were doing was in some way primal self-expression or rebellion, it never occurred to them. They were trying to turn a buck singing songs, and they were trying to make people happy.
You know, you wrote that Barry viewed his voice as an instrument, his guitar as a prop and a songwriting tool.
Yes, Barry, you know, in the disco era, starting with Jive Talking, Barry became a competent chicka-chicka rhythm guitar player. But he was never an instrumentalist. He was a great composer, a great producer. He created string charts in his head. He would hum all the string charts. He had frighteningly perfect pitch. But he was not foremost a musician. He was a songwriter foremost.
Did the boys ever graduate high school, and the fact that they were really undereducated in a way gave them lifelong insecurities?
Well, they had lifelong insecurities from being born extremely poor and outcast, and they were acting out as juvenile delinquents very, very young. They never had any education, as near as I can determine, except singing and playing. And they always felt like they were on the outside looking in, and that perpetuated them being on the outside looking in. They had no idea how to get in.
Tell us about their individual personalities at the peak of their career.
Well, you know, they were known as pissy, potty, and pilly. Pissy for the English expression of getting pissed to get drunk, and that was Morris, who had terrible problems with alcohol but got clean and sober before he died. Pilly for Robin, because Robin loved amphetamines and was addicted to amphetamines for a very, very long time. And potty for Barry, who was a big weed head. So their personalities were, Barry is, was, and always the indomitable alpha. Everything had to go Barry's way. He ran things and he did it his way. Morris, who was the elder of the younger of the two twins, took on the role as the compliant middle brother who would always help out anything. And he was, until the alcohol really overtook him, one of those musicians who, if he could touch it, he could play it. And you see him on their albums credited with guitar, bass, piano, mellotron, organ, you know, whatever he could get his hands on, he could play. And Robin was like the truculent younger brother, a good songwriter, but just an astonishing vocalist and not really a musician at all. And they say that in the studio, Robin would make comments like a producer, and he would make comments for shading things. And so I think because he wanted to sing more leads and because he fancied himself a songwriter also, the whole history of the band can be written in this dynamic. Barry running things, Robin struggling against his rule, Morris seeking to find his place and not fighting with either one.
We're speaking with David N. Meyer on The Book Report. Okay, tell us about the evolution of Saturday Night Fever.
The Bee Gees went to a recording studio in France at a chateau that Elton John had made famous earlier by calling it Honky Chateau, where he recorded his album Honky Chateau. It's a chateau, Hérouville. And they went there to record in France for tax reasons in this drafty backwater castle with a fairly crappy studio. And suddenly Stigwood shows up with this script and wants them to change their songs to be a soundtrack to this movie. They never read the script, and he described the movie to them only in the most superficial of terms. And they were all working on this dance material, and they changed the lyrics somewhat to reflect the things that he had described. And that's where it came from.
Were they there as the movie was being filmed? Did they ever meet Travolta?
I think they met Travolta during the publicity of things, but they were cutting tracks while the movie was being filmed. And there were some arguments because the director wanted to use an extended version of More Than a Woman rather than Staying Alive for the big dance sequence. And the Bee Gees would have none of it. And they were right to do it that way.
Okay, and after the film came out, how did that explosion of popularity affect them?
Well, you know, I think it really trashed their heads. Why wouldn't it? I mean, they were the biggest thing in the world for 18 months. And they sort of went about their business. They waited a tour till their next album. They kind of kept their heads down and went back in and cut another record. And whatever it was they were indulging in, their indulgences grew tremendously. They say that Morris spent $100 million on cars. Now, today, when a true collector car can cost $6 or $10 million, maybe that's not so difficult. But in the late 70s, to spend $100 million on cars is quite something.
Did they ever think in their brain that, okay, we've achieved this amazing pop success, we need to get more serious?
Well, they were very, very driven, and Barry is pretty much the most ambitious man on the planet. And they wanted to continue to make their own music, period. And then after the Spirits Having Flown tour, when they had pretty much conquered the world, they were sick of one another, they were sick of making music together, and that's when they turned their eye toward producing and writing for other artists. And Barry had this extraordinary, Barry with his brothers and with his producer Albie Gallatin and engineer Carl Richardson, because you don't want to say just Barry, had incredible success writing number ones for others. He wrote number ones for Diana Ross, for Dionne Warwick, for Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. He went in, he purpose-built these number ones, he produced their records, he changed their sounds, he resurrected all their careers.
And talk about, you know, the tragedies of many of them passing away.
Well, Andy, you know, the younger brother, he was the first person in history to have his first three songs go to number one. They were all written by Barry. And Andy never had good self-esteem, and he seeing his career as kind of Barry light was very hard on him, and he had a great appetite for cocaine. And he died of a heart attack at 30. Not of an overdose, as some people think, but as a heart condition that goes along with overindulgence in cocaine. Morris finally got sober with the help of his wife and opened a paintball studio in North Miami Beach. It's still there. He was crazy about paintball, insane for it. Has a paintball store, Commander Moe's paintball store. Still exists. And then he had a fluke medical condition, a twisted intestine, and died of a heart attack on the operating table. Robin, you know, abused himself with amphetamine pretty much forever and was very, very weak systemically and could not really fight off the cancer that killed him.
Talk about Barry and what he's doing now.
Well, in 2012, I saw what was billed as the first ever Barry Gibb solo concert at the Seminole Hard Rock. And he put on, you know, a 90-minute show that was quite something, and it was sold out. People went crazy for it. And indeed, he has been touring. He played a number of dates in Australia. He is touring England now. He's setting up to tour in America. And he's speaking more openly and honestly about his emotions, which he's never done in his whole life, and really talking about his brothers. So I think it's a new era of Barry.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.